today. I wanted to say at the end of the first class just a little bit about the nature of the course, indeed possibly to discourage some of you from taking the course. Or maybe it ought to be called Truth in Advertising. Over the years, this course has become more theoretical than it was 15 or 20 years ago. I used to focus much more on very specific environmental problems having to do with land use and energy and population and so on. I gradually became more interested myself and also came to believe that it was more important over the long term to focus more on theory, on those underlying attempts to get an underlying understanding of who we are as human beings, what terms like God, human being, nature mean. What does it mean, for instance, as some have asked, if we say we're fully a part of nature, what does it mean that we sometimes also say that we act unnaturally? I wanted to look at some of these larger issues. Towards the end of the course, we'll look more specifically at some of the theoretical tensions, say, between taking an anthropocentric or biocentric or theocentric view of our relation to nature. We'll ask questions, for instance, like, is a concern for the rights and welfare of individual animals, as over against ecosystems or entire species, is that really consistent with the latter? Can you be an environmentalist in the sense of paying particular attention to the interests of individual animals without a kind of inner contradiction, because generally we think of populations and whether species survive and so on. And if your concern is for individuals, will that undercut the latter? And we look at questions such as, can a liberal society such as ours, where many argue that we should focus on process and justice concerns but leave up to the individual choices about the nature of the good life, that government should not dictate for us what the good is in our individual lives or even in the life of the society as a whole, can one be a liberal in that sense and still be in favor of things like wilderness preservation, preservation of an endangered species, and so on? Those concerns do seem more closely related to what we have traditionally thought of as the good life or concerns for the good life. It's hard to argue that wilderness preservation in any simple sense is a justice concern. So we'll look at a variety of more theoretical issues, interspersing these considerations with practical examples. I won't try to avoid specific issues. I will have something to say about population, about land use, occasionally a word or two about energy, biotechnology, and so on. But those will not be our primary concern. This will not be a course where in 28 classes you're going to get 28 solutions to 28 practical environmental problems. And I seriously discourage you from taking the class if that's what you want. As I indicated, the feedback I get towards the end of the course, and even more so 5 or 10 years later, or even 2 or 3 years later, is that students, in retrospect, often find this more theoretical approach extremely useful because it gives them a handle on some of those philosophical and cultural movements and assumptions and commitments and so on that shape the way we structure these issues. We become very conscious and very self-consciously look at what are our underlying assumptions. What questions aren't we asking? How could we do some of these different if we were asking differently, if we were asking different questions? To what extent can we look at parts of the environmental movement and compare it with traditional religions? is there a kind of religion of nature that undergirds at least some segments of movements such as deep ecology and so on, that over the long run, I think this is extremely useful as well as interesting. The second point I would make is that the course will draw heavily on insights from the field of religion, somewhat less so from philosophy and ethics. We will spend some time looking at fairly basic methodological questions, such as what does it mean when we say we know something? What is knowledge? What are the similarities and differences between factual claims and moral or value or religious claims, and so on? And we will particularly draw rather heavily from the field of religion, and even more specifically from Western religion, and even more specifically from Judaism and Christianity, and probably more of the latter. And the reason for this is fairly straightforward. The first reason is that this is the area that I'm best educated in. My doctoral work was in the history and philosophy of religion. But at a more fundamental level, it's also the case that Christianity and Judaism have had a powerful shaping influence on how we think. And that some of the biggest tensions that we face in dealing with environmental issues are not really intelligible unless we know something of that background. We tend, for instance, today, to use one example, which we'll unpack later at some depth, simply to assume that rational behavior is self-interested behavior. Go back to Hobbes, Locke, Adam Smith, and so on. If you're acting rationally, you will act in your own self-interest. Some of the neo-Marxist critics, such as McPherson, in his book Possessive Individualism, argue that we even go so far as to equate rational behavior with acquisitive behavior. Now, that whole focus upon the individual self and rational behavior as maximizing the interests of the individual self, perhaps even the acquisitive self, stands in very sharp contrast to values that predominated not only in ancient Judaism and Christianity and through the Middle Ages, but also in various classical cultures. If we go back to some of the Stoic writings, or if we go back to some of the ancient dialogues of Socrates and so on, and it's extraordinarily helpful to become specifically aware of those tensions. Locke's view of property, which we'll look at in some detail, will contrast very sharply with older views going back to Aristotle or going back to the Jewish prophets or to the early Christian fathers, where we have much more of a communitarian emphasis. And the kinds of things I want to focus on will help us, I think, get a handle on many of the issues that we wrestle with and argue about today. Now, the reason I make these comments here is that occasionally some of you find it very difficult to make religion, and even more specifically Christianity, one of the foci, one of the focal points of a course, because you've been brought up on the belief that religion is essentially a private matter and that we don't deal with it in public. And I think if that conviction is strong enough, and if that's going to cast a pall over your working in the course, I would strongly urge you to drop it, because you may not be able to deal with some of the materials in a very incisive way, and you may not enjoy doing so. On the other hand, it's my own conviction that if you are willing to take the time and make the effort to understand materials, even where you disagree fundamentally with what is being said, let's say you're an agnostic, or even more so an atheist, or perhaps a Buddhist, and the emphasis on Judaism, let's say, or Western philosophy or Christianity is quite different from where you are, it seems to me that if you are willing to make that effort, this course offers the possibility of gaining insights which you will not gain in most of your Cornell courses unless you take some other courses in the area of religious studies. We have an increasing number of courses in that area, and some of those would expose you to similar types of material. But I mention that simply because I think it's important for you to be aware of that reasonably theoretical nature of the course and the fact that it will draw rather heavily on religion and also on ethics and philosophy. I've mentioned already that we're going to ask some of the big questions about who we are and what it all means and so on. And I think there's little doubt in my mind that we'll come to the end of the semester and many of these will remain unanswered, because these are the perennial questions. These are the questions with the tough answers. And these are the questions where women and men of goodwill disagree and differ from each other even after many hours and weeks and years of honest discussion. I have learned more during my years at Cornell from one of my graduate students, Harley Kahan, than perhaps anyone else at Cornell, student or faculty. Harley comes from a Jewish background. He's an atheist. But we just love to go over some of these questions together because we do sharpen each other's mind. We do open up new avenues of understanding precisely because some of our starting assumptions are so different. What is fascinating to me is how very much we agree on, is that even starting with very different assumptions, you can often find a kind of overlapping consensus about many issues. And I find that encouraging in terms of the future of a democratic, pluralistic society. It's important to ask the big questions, even though we're not going to be able to answer all of them. To be sure, reading the telephone book would give you certain kinds of information more quickly, and there's no question about the fact that the telephone book is easier to understand than Shakespeare or Goethe or the Book of Job or Immanuel Kant. It's a superb document for gaining one or two very limited kinds of information, but it's rather thin, we have to say, on plot and dramatic effect. It doesn't have much to say about what it means to be a human being. In this course, we're going to read material that stands more or less at the polar opposite of the telephone book. If you've already read the Thomas Merton piece, you will have some sense of what I mean. It's not a piece which you can weigh and count and analyze in an easy, objective, analytical manner, but it's a piece which, at least for many of us, speaks very deeply. This course will largely focus on normative rather than empirical questions. We will ask not mainly what is, but how ought we to live? What does the good life consist of? What is the nature of justice? What do we mean by right and wrong, good and bad? Now, let me immediately add a caveat here, because the longer I work in the field of ethics, the more apparent it becomes to me that many normative or moral or ethical disputes really are disputes about matters of fact, but matters of fact which are very difficult to resolve. Let me give you just one example. Most of the dispute over an issue like abortion is not a moral dispute or an ethical dispute, a normative dispute. The reason the dispute is really about, at heart, whether the fetus or the baby, notice how the terminology affects your conclusion, is a human being or not, or some would say, is a person or not, or is a human being deserving of the protection of the state? And the question, in one sense, of whether the fetus or baby is a human being is a very strange blend of normative and empirical. It's a factual question in some ways, but in another way, it's a normative or value question. And indeed, one of the things we're going to see as the course unfolds is that the radical dichotomy between facts and values that is so often assumed in the social sciences and so on does not hold up very well. In fact, most first-rate philosophers today are very skeptical of this radical separation between facts and values. In the case of abortion, if we were all agreed on the judgment that this is not a human being or a person, or if we were all agreed that it was, we probably would not have much argument. Because normally we see human beings or persons in our society as deserving of the full protection of the state. I mention this because we're going to see that a lot of the controversy, even in environmental issues, is not, first of all, a normative controversy at all, or let me qualify that, that's not quite accurate. I would say it's not necessarily mainly a normative question, but it's a question sometimes of effectiveness, of strategy, of what will work better, of what do we mean by nature, what is an animal, what is a human being. Is Tom Regan or Peter Singer, are they right when they argue that a sentient animal, for Regan, 1 year old or older, a qualification which has always puzzled me, that they are worthy of the same respect and treatment fundamentally as a human being, the same moral considerability? It doesn't mean that you treat them identically because we're different, but they're worthy of the same moral considerability. If one believes that, it has enormous impact on how you treat animals. Or to go even further, as Peter Taylor writes, we'll read one or two pieces by him late in the semester, that even plants are of equal value to human beings, that a blade of grass or a dandelion is as valuable as a human being. It's a fascinating position. It's one very difficult for me to comprehend, and yet it does stretch your mind. Those questions are a kind of strange mix between the normative and the empirical, and I think one of the most fascinating aspects of the course will be precisely that those boundaries which we have been taught, many of us, for so long that there is this sharp dichotomy between facts and values, that this may not hold up very well at all. So we'll focus on normative questions in religion, philosophy, ethics, and then try to relate these where we can to the environment. Ian Barber, in his book Issues in Sciences, Science and Religion, we're going to read a little bit of this later, recounts the story of a man who was looking for a pair of car keys under a street light. A stranger comes up to him and asks, "But are you sure you lost them here?" He says, "No, I'm not sure, but I can see better here." And in some ways, I think that's the kind of situation many of us are in. We're not sure that some of the questions we are asking at the university or that the media is presenting us with are all that worth asking, but at least they're easier and they don't demand too much of us, and we can sometimes get answers to them. Some of the texts we're going to read will seem exceedingly obscure, even opaque, to some of you, and it will be tempting to give up and to stop asking the tough questions. But it's my conviction that at least part of a university education ought to address these big questions if for no other reason than the fact that reading a telephone book and owner's manuals gets boring after a while. And that part of what it means to be a human being is that we ask these kinds of questions. As I was working on this lecture a couple days ago, I was getting tired and was reflecting a little bit on the fact that there are certain advantages to being in my 60s rather than in my 30s or 40s or 50s. There are also a lot of disadvantages, as you well know, stiff joints and diminished energy, and your mind isn't quite as quick as it was. But there are some advantages, at least sometimes. And one of those for me, I think, is that the older I get, the less certain I am of some of the answers to the big questions. I haven't become skeptical. I believe there are answers and I am committed to them, but I'm more aware of the ambiguity in much of human existence. St. Paul says we see through a glass darkly, dimly. And I, looking back over the years, become more and more acutely aware that some of the greatest mischief that has ever been affected in human history has been affected by very good people who wanted to achieve perfection tomorrow or today or even yesterday, who had an image, an ideal, a vision of the good life, but were impatient. They were zealous. They wanted to change life quickly and reach the kingdom of God on earth tomorrow. I think that's probably one of the major criticisms that could be made of Marxism. Many of the ideals of Marxism are incredibly fine ideals. It's not hard for me to say that. They represent, to a large extent, a radical secularization of Jewish concepts of justice, concepts from the Old Testament prophets, and so on. There's a lot of very good things in Marxist ideology about justice and so on, but there's a kind of impatience with human beings as they really are. Victor Firkas, in his book Technological Man, was writing about the Catholic philosopher Teilhard de Chardin, whom Firkas did not much like. I've never quite been able to make up my mind whether I like Teilhard's work or not. I think the older I get, the less I like it. But Firkas referred to Teilhard's impatience with the messiness of ordinary human life, comma, the mark of the true totalitarian. His impatience with the messiness of ordinary human life, the mark of the true totalitarian. And I think that is a very wise comment. There is a kind of messiness to human life, individually, societally, economically, in almost every respect. And if we somehow think we can run roughshod over the realities that are and change everybody quickly, I sometimes think we end up doing a great deal of harm. Now, that doesn't mean I'm a quietist. It doesn't mean that I think we should drift over into a kind of mystical relationship and just let it all drift and float and flow with the tide. There is some wisdom in that too, and at times in our lives we need to let it flow a little more gently. But it means that I think as we try to change the world about us and ourselves, that there's the need for a certain patience and generosity. very late in the course, I shall argue that we need to be generous and patient even towards our enemies. One of the interesting things about religion in modern American life, particularly the academy, is that many people, sometimes especially politicians, but perhaps less so than when I was your age, many people say nice things about religion. They make the proper bows to Americans' religious beliefs, but they don't take it very seriously in the real world. And one of the reasons this is so is because it's the conventional wisdom for many people today, particularly in academia, that religion ought to be relegated to the realm of the private and the personal. I commented on this Tuesday that there are some analogies between the way the Victorians allegedly dealt with their own sexuality and the way we today deal with religion. Religion is seen by many today as the realm of emotion, of faith, of feeling. It doesn't have much to do with the real world of fact and numbers and the way things actually are. Secular thinking is the realm of reason, of knowledge, of facts, but religion is the realm of faith. And I think that that is part of the reason why it has become difficult to talk about religion easily in the modern university setting. Many of us simply have the feeling that it's slightly obscene to talk openly and easily about one's religious beliefs. That's a very private, personal matter. I'm going to suggest that to do that, in effect, is to ghettoize religion. It's to emasculate it, to take away its power to shape and form culture. And that one of the things we need to do in a democratic pluralistic society is to learn how to talk about our deepest beliefs, philosophical, metaphysical, religious, in a civil and rational and generous manner. Let's look a little bit about what I've entitled Religion and the Human Condition. I'd like to point to what is sometimes referred to as a tripartite or threefold process that is very much a part of most religion, and also, I would argue, of large-scale secular or philosophical interpretations of human existence. This really is a fairly commonplace analysis among sociologists, anthropologists, and philosophers of religion. Most religion, perhaps all to some degree, tends to presuppose that there was an ideal state of humanity or of the self or of human beings which existed at one time, but which was lost, but which also can be regained. In Judaism and Christianity, you have the story of the Garden of Eden, a kind of primordial bliss, human beings living in harmony with nature and with God. Marxists have a secularized version of this, that there was one time when we did not have money and capital, and people had work that was meaningful. They were not slaves to the capitalists and the industrial complex. You see a certain form of this in some liberal thinking about education. Let me first take another example, perhaps an easier one. Some of the tenets of Romanticism, that there was a time when human beings live simpler lives. You can see some of this among some of the deep ecologists. They lived in harmony with nature, small-scale crafts and hunting and gathering. They didn't exploit one another or nature, but lived simple lives. And then something, as we look at our lives today, that we have to look at the actual condition of human beings. Some flaw or defect separates people from the ideal. In Christian and Jewish and Islamic terms, sin. In the thinking of the Enlightenment and those who rely heavily on education and knowledge, ignorance. For Marxists, economic oppression. Some psychologists had a kind of tripartite division that the problem is that instead of living in our deeper self in touch with these harmonies that are part of the unconscious and the more emotional, physical part of the being, we've lived too much in our heads. We've become too intellectual. The actual condition of human beings contrasts with the ideal. And then thirdly, there is some saving power that can overcome the flaw and reestablish the ideal. A personal redeemer, education, revolution, cleaning up the environment, whatever it may be. And this seems to be a fairly universal typology for understanding religion and large-scale metaphysical systems. As I've indicated, it's very, very obvious in Christianity and Judaism. It's just as obvious in a secular version such as Marxist. The actual condition is one of enslavement to the capitalists, to hourly wages and so on. The saving power will come through the revolution and the rule of the proletariat. I think the dominant ideology in the university in some ways is that the villain is superstition, is ignorance, and the saving power comes to be knowledge and science and technology and so on. And I think it's helpful to have this kind of technology in mind. You can go back in many religious traditions, and there's a kind of Garden of Eden type of scenario. The Germans have the word Urzeit, U-R-Z-E-I-T, the primordial time, the beginning of time. And we'll see this in a very, very striking way in the literature of some of the deep ecologists, where there's a kind of glorification of primal or primitive societies, where they were doing everything right. And there's a very strong Luddite sort of emphasis, an anti-technological theme running through the deep ecology literature. If we could just get rid of a great deal of the science and technology and large-scale bureaucracy and so on, we would be in harmony with the environment once more. And then contrasted to the primordial Garden of Eden is the heavenly Jerusalem, the end site, the end time, the kingdom of God. In Marxism, this is a classless society. In much liberal thinking, it's a society where we have learned how to treat each other justly and where we have enough science and learning and understanding, education, to be able to overcome superstition and to make what are rational judgments about our own lives and about how we treat one another. In Christianity, the movement is a movement from sin to salvation through Jesus Christ and some time in the future participation in the heavenly Jerusalem. And this kind of tripartite division, I think, will be useful to us as we ask what's really going on in some of the environmental movements around us, I'm going to make the claim, whether it's plausible or not, you shall have to decide, that in some significant ways, some aspects of the environmental movement are essentially religious in nature. That nature itself becomes the divine presence in a way. Sin is the destruction of nature, exploitation of other creatures, the wanton disregard for the biological and ecological harmonies of the world about us. For some environmentalists, salvation comes through a return to a more simple life, and so on. And the kingdom of God will be a much smaller number of human beings, perhaps a few hundred million, living in very small, decentralized communities, in harmony with nature. And why I'm particularly interested in this is that I think there's something on the one hand very winsome in some of these beliefs. I, for the life of me, cannot understand Paul Taylor's assertion that even a dandelion is as valuable as a human being, but it does get me thinking about these matters, and at least in a less extreme form, I have a lot of sympathy for those who want to push us away from the extreme anthropocentrism that has so dominated our thinking about nature over much of the last four centuries. Some would say even longer than that. So to try to get a handle on some of these philosophical and metaphysical and religious aspects of the problem, I think will, in the long run, be very useful to us. The whole theme of the return to nature, the theme of which there may be some inklings, I'm not quite sure how serious they are, in the Merton reading of The Evil City. You may want to talk about that a little, whether that's a fundamental theme or incidental to the piece. These are themes which I think we need to analyze in some considerable detail if we're going to make progress in this area. I have a whole new section I want to move into here, but let me pause and see, because I'm a little hesitant to move into it with only 10 minutes left. Let me get a little reaction from you, or a little time for questions or comments. I'm always interested, as I start a course again each year, where you are and what you're thinking. It's partly because I see teaching very much as a two-way process. Give me some reactions. What are you thinking about? We don't have them right here. When we actually do discussions, in fact, Jim, from now on, would you get the two wands? We have these portable mics. You might grab them now, Jim. We have 10 minutes. So that you can hear each other. Any comments or thoughts? What's going through your heads? Yes. Okay. In fact, the very next section of the course, Jim, give Carl one of those too, and spread out so that we can use these. In the very next section of the course, we're going to address something fairly similar to that. I'm going to talk about some of the contrasts between God and religion, and argue that sometimes religion becomes an enemy of God, which would be fairly similar to that. And maybe you might want to say something more about that after that that section of the course. And obviously we have very different reactions to the term religion, because a great deal of mischief has been achieved in human history because of religion. One of the interesting things, though, at that point that I keep coming back to, that I think reflects some of the bias of the university, we often will hear people make references to the Salem witch trials and to the Inquisition and the Hundred Year Wars, the wars in Europe. But what is fascinating to me is that in our own day, the great, great, great preponderance of violence and deaths and genocide has come from secular ideologies rather than what we would think of as traditional religious ideologies. And that's partly why I'm going to try to broaden the term. And any other comments or so on? We have these portable mics, so you can be heard easier. Thank you for that. That was helpful. And we will move, treat some materials that will partly deal with that. Mm-hmm. Give me some clue as to, yes, down here, Jim, as to what's going through your minds. We'll occasionally have 30 or 40 minutes where we're going to worry some specific questions together, and we'll use a kind of dialogic method. Yes, hold it up very close to your mouth so people can hear.
I'm going to fall into the category that you discussed of stretching your mind.
Okay.
To be blunt from my own life experiences, I've had some very negative reactions towards Christianity. So mm-hmm. I've decided to stay in the class and to attempt to wade through that and to find out the different views. And I'm in the natural resource program. So it's very interesting to me that I can be in a class that will address the issues that you're talking about from the Christian perspective, and mm-hmm. to try to get some more insight into how that works and the positive sides of it and the negative sides of it.
Good. Well, I congratulate you for precisely keeping an open mind and being willing to hear another point of view. To me, that's the very essence of what education in a pluralistic society ought to be about. And that's why I desperately miss Harley Payen, my atheist Jewish friend, because life has gotten sort of dull. Jim, you do pretty well at times, and Carl is just starting, and Mikhail, we agree on too many things. Mikhail, my other graduate student, comes from a fairly traditional Jewish background, but we just agree on too many things. You've got to provoke me a little more. Good. I think that's what it's about. And we got a few minutes yet. Any other questions or comments? These are helpful to see a little bit where you're at. Yes, Carl, right. It works the best if you hold the mic about an inch from your mouth. Then we can all hear you very well.
I just have a question about something that you were talking about earlier.
You said
that religion has become very secretive and has become the emotion of us and our feelings and all that. It hasn't always been that way, historically, from what I understand. Why do you think that happened?
I think that we have been engaged in what loosely could be called a culture war between different visions of the good society. And one of the visions coming out of the Enlightenment is that religion has tended to oppress human beings, has tended to lead to superstition, has held us in ignorance, has led to great injustice, and indeed all of that is true to some extent. I think we can say quite clearly that religion has created a lot of mischief in human affairs, so that view has tended to become the orthodoxy, not quite in that pointed a form, but has tended to become the orthodoxy of the modern secular world. And I think of the media. You know, it's fascinating, and next week we're going to explore this at some length, but how many of us really think about the fact that more people are in church or synagogue or mosque every Saturday or Sunday than go to professional sporting events, at least baseball and football, all year long? How many of us here, if we look at any of these soap operas, which I hope you don't, I won't tell you whether I did. Yes, I will. I don't. How many times do you ever see people sitting around praying together over the kitchen table or studying the Bible together, and yet tens of millions of Americans do that regularly? How many of you see what actually goes on in our lives? Next week, I'm going to suggest that there is a massive censorship by omission about how Americans actually live. Because of this kind of struggle between different worldviews and the feeling that religion is very private. And I think if for no other reason, this is tragic, because you can't really understand who we are as a people. We have to be more open to each other in our atheistic beliefs, our secular beliefs, our Jewish beliefs, whatever they may be, humanist, Christian, because that's who we are. So there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think part of it was this kind of struggle between different views of what the world and the public life should be like. I mean, it's very interesting to recall the fact that only 125 years ago, virtually every major college and university in the country, Cornell was an exception, had a minister or a priest as its president or dean, and that there were, in many cases, required chapel and all of that. That's a huge shift in a period of three or four generations. So there are a lot of reasons for that. Let me just close with one kind of... No, I don't have time to do it. Yeah. Let me do that instead. Thank you very much for these comments and questions. I have just a word about the sections. This is helpful because it does give me a sense of where you're at. We do have sections this week. Carl will be at one exit or and Jim at the other. Else, let's just put them on the tables on both sides. Get these sheets that give your section assignments. If you're not on the sheet or if you're just registering now, see me. And also, if you didn't get the questions for week two, Jim, would you put some of those on the other side, too, the questions, so they can get them on both sides? So you should get the section assignments and questions for week two. Thank you.